I know I'll be harshly criticized for writing that last paragraph, but as I ask, think about it. How could any sane person adopt the stance the ACLU takes towards the war on terror? Don't these people get 9/11? Doesn't the SP movement understand the danger America faces from terrorist fanatics who would use nuclear weapons, should they acquire them, against us? The answer to that question is a bit complicated, but it's rooted in the one thing that the secular progressive movement and Al-Qaeda have in common. Both outfits believe the USA is fundamentally a bad place. Again, I'll be criticized for writing that. So let's back it up and return to our pal George Lakoff, the premier SP philosopher and guru. Like most SP true believers, Lakoff believes that the United States is at least partially responsible for the buildup of worldwide terrorism. Therefore, by that reasoning, it was some of America's own doing that it was attacked on 9/11. That point of view is obviously a tough sell to the American public, so the ACLU and others do not bring the hypothesis up very often. But Lakoff makes the SP position crystal clear on page 66 of his Elephant Book. Quote, "The idealistic claim of the Bush administration is that they intend to wipe out all terrorism. What is not mentioned is that the USA has systematically promoted a terrorism of its own and has trained terrorists from the Contras to the Mujahideen, the Honduran death squads, and the Indonesian military. Will the U.S. government stop training terrorists? Of course not. It will deny that it does so. If the U.S. wants to end terror, the United States must end its own contribution to terror." Unquote. So the war on terror is largely America's fault, according to Lakoff, who conveniently avoids mentioning America's fight against the expansion of worldwide communism. As any intelligent person knows, the brutal Cold War against the Soviet Union and Red China was the primary reason the United States armed opponents of communism like the Contras in Nicaragua and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. This is so typical of Lakoff and the other SP thinkers. They ignore all perspective in their analysis. When was the last time you heard any SP fanatic mention that almost 3 million people were slaughtered by communist forces in Southeast Asia after the USA withdrew from Vietnam? I've never heard Jane Fonda, a duchess of the SP realm, mention that, have you? The bedrock belief is that America is and has been an evil country, and that's crucial to understanding the secular progressive point of view when it comes to the war on terror. Here's their bankrupt reasoning. The SPs cannot support any anti-terror measures until the USA stops being a terrorist country itself. Get it? Yes, they're serious. And if you don't believe me, travel to Berkeley, California, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ask. Now, I first came across this thinking when I interviewed a man named Jeremy Glick on The Factor shortly after the attack on 9/11. Mr. Glick's father had been murdered in the collapse of the World Trade Center. Despite that tragedy, Jeremy had signed his name to an advertisement paid for by a radical SP group called Not in Our Name. Part of that ad suggested an outrageous equivalency. Quote, "We too watch with shock after the horrific events of September 11th. We too mourn the thousands of innocent dead in Baghdad, Panama City, and a generation ago, Vietnam." Unquote. Wow. Comparing the 9/11 attack, which resulted in the murders of about 3,000 innocent civilians, to the defeat of Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War? Remember, he invaded Kuwait and brutalized the people there. To the removal of Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, who had turned his country into an international narcotics shipping center? And to the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, a war that was fought to prevent the spread of totalitarianism, communism? I just couldn't believe a young man like Jeremy Glick was nutty enough to sign his name to that kind of a display. There must have been some sort of misunderstanding. Maybe it was part of his grieving process. Wrong again, culture warrior. In what has now become a famous TV verbal shootout, Glick came on The Factor and told me my criticism of the ad was dead wrong. Moreover, he opined, my surprise at his participation was naive. Quote, "I'm actually surprised that you're surprised," Glick told me. "If you think about it, our current president, who I feel and many feel, is in this position illegitimately by neglecting the voices of African Americans in the Florida coup, Our current president now inherited a legacy from his father and inherited a political legacy that's responsible for training militarily, economically, and situating geopolitically the parties involved in the alleged assassination and murder of my father and countless of others. Unquote. The alleged assassination of his father? Glick was asserting that not only was the Bush administration partially responsible for the murderous actions of Al-Qaeda, the administration also might even have had something directly to do with 9/11 by supporting groups like the Mujahideen in the past. Now, when you get a misguided individual like Jeremy Glick on television, you simply cannot allow him to spout unproved accusations and downright slander. If you do that, your audience will turn on you. Add in the suffering Glick's words could bring to others who lost loved ones on 9/11, and you have to pull the plug, which I did. Glick got the boot after this exchange. Glick, quote, "You evoke 9/11 to rationalize everything from domestic plunder to imperialistic aggression worldwide. You evoke sympathy with the 9/11 families." O'Reilly, "That's a bunch of crap. I've done more for the 9/11 families by their own admission than you will ever hope to do." Glick, okay. O'Reilly, "So keep your mouth shut when you sit here exploiting those people." Glick, "Well, you're not representing me." O'Reilly, "I'd never represent you." Glick, "Why?" O'Reilly, "Because you have a warped view of this world and a warped view of this country." Glick, "Well, explain that." O'Reilly, "All right. You didn't support the action against Afghanistan or remove the Taliban. You were against it, okay?" Glick, "Why would I want to brutalize and further punish the people in Afghanistan?" Unquote. Why indeed, when the whole thing was America's fault from the get-go? That's Glick think, taken directly from the George Lakoff playbook. It was pathetic. Subsequently, thanks to me, Jeremy Glick became an icon of the SP movement, which celebrated his bravery in standing up to the barbarian O'Reilly. A few years later, the SPs tried the same trick with Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey, a dedicated professional American soldier, was killed in the Iraq War. Ms. Sheehan, you may remember, demanded a meeting with President Bush, even though she had already had one. But Ms. Sheehan wanted another chat after being tutored by anti-war zealots. Of course, Mr. Bush saw the trap a mile away. He rightly assumed Cindy Sheehan wanted to embarrass him, and he ignored the woman. Thereupon, some of the media castigated the president for his insensitivity and made Cindy Sheehan into a heroine. The pro-Sheehan media blitz worked for a few weeks until I, convinced the whole deal was calculated, played an audio clip of Ms. Sheehan telling Mark Knoller of CBS Radio that the terrorists in Iraq were, quote, freedom fighters, unquote. She also said Israel was a terrorist nation. And after that exposition, Ms. Sheehan's star dimmed as many rational folks who had sympathized with her because of Casey turned away. Now, the important point here is that the secular progressive movement really believes Jeremy Glick and Cindy Sheehan are heroes. Worse, the SPs absolutely think the world's foremost problem is the evil superpower America, not Islamic fascist terror cells. If you take one thing away from this book, ladies and gentlemen, let it be that. The SP brigades are not capable of understanding true evil. Their world perspective is so warped, it might even be downright dangerous. A question then logically follows. How would the secular progressives themselves deal with Islamic terrorism? Paging George Lakoff, he deals with that very issue on page 60 of his training manual. Quote, "Most Islamic would-be martyrs not only share fanatical religious beliefs, but have also grown up in a culture of despair. They have nothing to lose. Eliminate such poverty, and you eliminate the breeding ground for terrorists." When the Bush administration speaks of eliminating terror, it does not appear to be talking about eliminating cultures of despair and the social conditions that lead one to want to give up his life to martyrdom, unquote. Outstanding. George Lakoff apparently believes the USA has the power to eliminate poverty and change social conditions in places like Pakistan, estimated population 163 million. America can't even eliminate poverty and change social conditions in Detroit, much less Islamabad. No government can impose prosperity or benign thinking on masses of people. It's simply impossible. But George Lakoff and the SPs don't care for rational analysis. It sounds so good to say that terrorism can be defeated by a change in America's foreign policy. More Lakoff, quote, "What is needed is a new kind of moral foreign policy, one that realizes that America can only be a better America if the world is a better world. America must become a moral leader, using fundamental human values, caring and responsibility, carried out with strength to respond to the world's problems." Unquote. Once again, Lakoff seems to have missed the truth of America's great sacrifice in defeating the Soviet Union's totalitarianism, and thereby bringing freedom to tens of millions of people in Eastern Europe and other Soviet-dominated areas. Nor does the SP guru mention the enormous blood and treasure America spent defeating the Nazis in Imperial Japan. Don't those historic achievements fall under the category of caring and responsibility carried out with strength to respond to the world's problems? Or did the USA bring World War II upon itself as well? It galls me that the SPs can get away with denigrating the USA when it, along with Great Britain and a precious few other countries, is standing up against a homicidal jihad that could destroy the world. The SP's unrealistic assessment of the war on terror is dangerous, naive, and disqualifies the secular progressive movement from any serious participation in the post-9/11 decision-making process. Sure, it would be great to heal social ills all over the world by waving a magic wand, but why bother spouting such delusional nonsense? The SPs are at their best when proposing airy theories or undermining policies with which they disagree. They fail dismally, however, when asked to create better, more effective policies to protect and improve the lives of everyday folks. But that failure does not deter them. They are convinced they hold the high moral ground, and those who oppose them, their enemies in the culture war, must be marginalized for the good of all. And so I have arrived at this necessary conclusion. All clear-thinking Americans should become opponents of the SP movement for the simple reason of self-preservation. If the secular progressives ever come to power in America, and remember Howard Dean got close, their policies would put you and your family in grave danger. Osama and his pals would love to face off against Lakoff, Dean, Michael Moore, George Soros, and the rest of the soft secular crew. In the 1930s, Adolf Hitler had a blast with Neville Chamberlain, the appeasement-supporting Prime Minister of Great Britain. That historical lesson might be worth revisiting in the culture war between the traditionalists and the SPs. Oh, and one more thing. If you really want to see just how caring and humane the secular progressive movement is, visit some of their black-hearted websites. If the hatred and libel you see are examples of SP caring, somewhere the Marquis de Sade is cheering. One of the reasons I'm writing this book is the great divide between how the SPs frame their arguments and their actual conduct. Many of these people are as ruthless as anyone you'd see in the Bush administration, but they hide behind the nurturing and enlightenment themes. To use an old Levittown expression, what a crock. Chapter 8, Where's Mine? God helps them that help themselves. Poor Richard's Almanac, 1736. Way back in 1776, a committee that included Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and others decided to include the Latin words E Pluribus Unum on the first Great Seal of the United States. Actually, a man named Pierre Eugene du Simeter came up with the idea. I have no idea who that man was, but great name, right? The motto E Pluribus Unum means from many, one, thereby reflecting the integration of the 13 colonies into one country. Subsequently, the words took on a deeper meaning as immigrants from all over the world brought their talents and energy and desire for freedom to the USA, fueling its rapid rise in power and prosperity. Yes, it's an old story that may have put you to sleep in high school, but it's worth thinking about. The USA is the strongest nation the world has ever seen because so many pull together to create the one. But in today's culture, from many one no longer applies on the secular progressive side. Their motto might be, where's mine? Ubi est meum. Remember, The SPs believe that the government has an obligation to provide Americans with prosperity and happiness. This philosophy is, of course, in direct conflict with the vision of the Founding Fathers. They did not want government to provide. They wanted it to get out of our way. They imagined and designed a system whereby freedom and capitalism would give most Americans an opportunity to pursue happiness. What you did with that opportunity was up to you. Of course, it's certainly true that Americans born into poverty don't have the same opportunity as those born into wealth. There are also many other kinds of inequities, like innate intelligence, in play in America and everywhere else. In addition, as acknowledged earlier, the sad truth is that for more than 200 years, most black Americans were systematically deprived of the right to pursue happiness, and Native Americans were brutalized as America was being settled. Thus, the government today does owe African and Native Americans, and the poor in general, more attention and specific entitlement programs to help level the playing field. On that, most traditionalists and SPs can agree. But the SP notion that the U.S. government has the right to seize private property, which is exactly what the estate tax achieves, for example, but under stealth wording, or redistribute legally earned income from the affluent to the poor, runs counter to the founding spirit of America in every way. Look at the evidence. The USA became the strongest nation on earth because individuals working their butts off created a unified powerhouse. These individuals, from many different nations and backgrounds, bought into the idea of pursuing the American dream. That is, they chose to live an honest life that affords the individual and his or her family security and comfort backed by the freedom necessary for accomplishing these worthy goals. Americans fought and died for these principles. They are still fighting and dying today, liberating people from tyranny in Afghanistan and Iraq. Any erosion of the American ideal, which these secular progressives are attempting by espousing the entitlement state, would drastically weaken the nation. Now, call me a crazy traditionalist, but I don't believe General George Soros could have defeated the Soviet Union or the Nazis or Tojo's fanatical Japanese military. I don't believe Howard Dean could command respect in any armed conflict and most likely would appease all over the place to avoid one in the first place. Why do I believe so strongly that the SP movement is clueless as to how to deal with the evil in the world? Simple. To them, as their leaders admit, evil doesn't really exist. Evil is actually redirected personal pain. Evil is a cry for help and can be persuaded to be good through kindness and caring. Stalin, Mao, and Hitler would all have changed direction if only Barbara Streisand could have sung "People Who Need People" to them in her very meaningful way. Too harsh? No way. History has demonstrated time and time again that disciplined, just societies prevail while weak, utopian systems crash and burn. Life is tough, and we all have to deal with that, not buy into fantasies that could get us killed. The world is and always has been a struggle between good and evil. The Bible and the stark reality of the world teach us that. But as we all know, the Bible is not on the secular progressive recommended reading list. On the home front in America, traditional forces strongly believe that their hard-earned money is not the property of the government, to be distributed as largesse to others who perhaps are not willing to work to earn prosperity. On a personal note, I don't want my money being given to substance abusers, for example. Why should my money allow them to continue leading lives of dissolution? I donate money to drug and alcohol rehabilitation clinics like the DOE Fund, but I strenuously object to welfare payments for substance abusers to buy more substance. I work hard for my money, and I don't want to support anyone who lives irresponsibly, period. Traditionalists like me understand that taxes are needed to keep the country strong and safe and to maintain an infrastructure that benefits the many. But cradle-to-grave entitlements, embraced fervently by the SP movement, are rejected by traditionalists who understand that they foster weakness and sap initiative. You only have to travel to Europe to see the difference that an entitlement culture makes. While the USA is a vibrant, creative, and exciting place, Europe today is largely stagnant. Workers there have little incentive to move ahead because the rate of taxation is punishing and the governments guarantee a certain standard of living. In France, young people demonstrated for weeks because the government wanted a new law that would allow employers to actually fire them during the first 2 years of employment if they screwed up on a regular basis. But no, we can't have that. The French sense of entitlement basically says, you owe me prosperity, government. You owe me. Where have we heard that before? Paging George Lakoff. For those reasons and more, Europe has grown weak and frightened in the face of intense conflict, leaving it to America to protect them. And we do, even as the USA continues to grow economically and provide incredible opportunities for upward mobility. You are reading the words of the poster boy for upward mobility, by the way. It is actually laughable to hear the SPs moan about economic injustice in the USA when we all know there's a flood of immigrants, both legal and illegal, trying to get into America. Surely if the American system was as bad as the SPs claim, people would not be coming such great distances and at great risk to get into this country. So you can either believe your eyes or believe the SP socialist propaganda. Up to you. So once again, out with E pluribus unum, that phrase is simply not nurturing enough. The brand new SP motto is inclusive, caring, and pithy. Ubi est meum, where's mine? If the SPs ever do take control of America, that phrase will ring loudly from sea to shining sea. Where is mine? I want it right now. And if I can't get stuff for myself, I'll take yours. I am owed prosperity, even if I don't want to earn it. Is that the kind of country in which you want to live? If so, France might be your next stop. By the way, the SPs love France. Says a lot about them. But then again, France is far away, and many of us don't really care about it. What we do care about is our own neighborhoods. So let's go there now. Part 2 of Culture Warrior. The Culture War, Where You Live. Chapter 9, The Battle for the Kids. Control the children, and you control the future. The Art of Culture War, O'Reilly Sue. It was just another day in the San Juan Islands village of Friday Harbor, Washington, population 2,000, when Sheriff Bill Cumming got a call that an elderly woman had been mugged. Apparently two young men had knocked the lady to the ground, grabbed her purse, and run off. Since Friday Harbor is not exactly South Central Los Angeles, the sheriff had a good idea that a local troublemaker named Oliver Christensen may have been involved. There were only a few hellions in the little town, and Christensen immediately became a suspect. Sheriff Cumming also knew that Christensen, 17, was dating 14-year-old Lacey Dixon, a troubled young girl who lived at home with her single mother, Carmen Dixon. Doing what any good law enforcement official would do, the sheriff called Mrs. Dixon and asked her to find out if her daughter had any knowledge of the crime. The next time Oliver Christensen called the Dixon house, Lacey took her cordless phone into her bedroom and shut the door. But unbeknownst to the girl, her mother snapped on a speakerphone in the kitchen and was taking notes. Sure enough, Christensen bragged to the 14-year-old that he had hidden the elderly woman's purse in some bushes. Based partially upon the information Carmen Dixon subsequently provided authorities and her testimony in court, Christensen was convicted by a jury of second-degree robbery and sentenced to a couple of years in the state prison. Subsequently, his conviction was upheld by a Washington State appeals court, but then the big guns of the secular army were brought in. The ACLU, ignoring the actual crime, mounted an intense campaign to free Oliver Christensen based on the theory that Carmen Dixon had violated her daughter's privacy by listening to her phone conversation. ACLU lead attorney Douglas Cunder was blunt. Quote, I don't think the state should be in the position of encouraging parents to act surreptitiously and eavesdrop on their children. Unquote. Disturbingly, the very liberal and secular Washington Supreme Court eventually sided with the ACLU, and Christensen's conviction was overturned. The court ruled that the 14-year-old's privacy had indeed been violated, and her mother had no legal right to the information she had gleaned from her daughter's conversation with the assailant. Carmen Dixon was stunned and told the media, quote, It's ridiculous. Kids have more rights than parents these days. My daughter was out of control, and that was the only way I could get information and keep track of her, unquote. The prosecutor, Randall Gaylord, was also outraged, quote, I'm concerned that a 14-year-old's right to privacy now trumps the parent's right to be a parent, unquote. Even the Associated Press, no bastion of traditional thought, began its news story on the court's decision this way, quote, In a victory for rebellious teenagers, the state Supreme Court ruled that a mother violated Washington's privacy law by eavesdropping on her daughter's phone conversation, unquote. The state of Washington did retry Christensen, this time without Carmen Dixon's testimony. A jury again found him guilty, but he walked free after 9 months in prison because the judge, Vicki Churchill, declined to give him more jail time. All of this skirmishing cost the taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars. And what did it really accomplish? Well, if you're in the SP Corps, it accomplished a lot for your side. Remember, the ACLU is not an organization that does anything in a vacuum. The SP spearhead knew exactly what it wanted to achieve when it marched into Carmen Dixon's life. That is, a court ruling demonstrating that a parent has no right to supervise a child surreptitiously. For the secular progressive movement to achieve their goals in America, it must undermine traditional parental authority and convince children there's a brave new world out there that does not include being raised in a traditional way. The SP goal is to diminish parental authority that, in the past, had been unquestioned. This is a strategy, mentally separate children from their parents, that has been practiced by totalitarian governments all throughout history. In Nazi Germany, there was the Hitler Youth. Chairman Mao created the Children's Corps in China. Stalin and Castro rewarded children who spied on their parents. That's the blueprint. If you want to change a country's culture and traditions, children must first abandon them and embrace a new vision. Hello, secular progressivism in the USA. I'm not saying these people are little Adolfs. I am saying they have adopted some totalitarian tactics in their strategies. Another factor in the SP vision for our kids is the development of sexual awareness at an early age. This strategy encourages children to mimic adult behavior and forge relationships outside the home. Thus, children separate themselves from parental influence earlier in life and are less likely to embrace the old school values of their parents. Here's a pretty amazing example of what I'm talking about. A few years ago in Los Angeles County, the Palmdale School District came up with an educational survey for students ages 7 to 10. As part of that survey, the kids were asked to rate the following activities according to how often they experienced the thought or emotion. 1. Touching my private parts too much. 2. Thinking about having sex. 3. Thinking about touching other people's private parts. 4. Thinking about sex when I don't want to. 5. Washing myself because I feel dirty inside. Remember, these questions were put to kids as young as 7 years old. Do you think about having sex? What the heck is going on? Outraged, a group of Palmdale parents asked that exact question. But because school officials dodged and weaved, they couldn't get any answers. So the parents sued the district in federal court. The issue went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most liberal federal court in U.S. history. Predictably, the court ruled against the parents. Judge Stephen Reinhardt, whose wife, Ramona Ripston, is the executive director of the ACLU in Southern California, can you believe this? Wrote the unanimous opinion, which stated that parents of public school children have no fundamental right to be the exclusive provider of sexual information to their children. Reinhardt was direct, quote, Parents are possessed of no constitutional right to prevent the public schools from providing information on that subject, sex, to their students in any form or manner they select, unquote. Consider the implications. By that reasoning, a school could conceivably bring in a dominatrix to describe the glories of S&M to first graders, and parents would have no recourse. But Reinhardt wasn't through. This incredible pinhead went on to write, quote, No such specific parental right can be found in the deep roots of the nation's history and tradition or implied in the concept of ordered liberty, unquote. This kind of intellectual gibberish is part of the SP Manifesto, which even denies that, throughout American history, parents have traditionally had full discretion in matters of sexual disclosure to their children. Think about it. The SPs are now saying that the government should be allowed to introduce your kid to sexual matters, even if you, the parent, object. Whatever the authorities choose, in whatever form, and in pursuit of whichever point of view is acceptable to the courts. Benjamin Franklin would have had these people caned. Obviously, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is firmly in a secular camp. You may remember that it was this very crew that ruled the words under God and the Pledge of Allegiance were unconstitutional. That ruling, thank God, was thrown out, and indeed the Ninth has been overturned about 75% of the time by the U.S. Supreme Court, according to Cal Law, California's legal news source. Even so, the fact that a powerful judicial body like this believes parents should have virtually no say in what their young children see and hear about sex in the public school system is beyond chilling. Of course, parents who do not want their 7-year-olds asked if they thought about having sex were shocked. Their lawsuit against the school district was based on the belief that they had been deprived of their right to control the upbringing of their children by introducing them to matters of and relating to sex in accordance with their personal and religious values and beliefs. Silly them, thinking parents have a right to bring up their own kids according to a specific belief system. Now, you will not be surprised to learn that the initial sex survey ruling propelled waves of joy throughout the SP ranks. Parental authority had been radically diminished by a federal court, and as noted, that is a primary secular progressive goal. Our SP pal George Lakoff puts it bluntly, quote, "Children are shaped by their communities," unquote. The emphasis on the word communities is provided by Lakoff himself on page 90 of his Elephant book. The SP strategy with respect to children is not subtle. You can't achieve a brave new world without tearing down the bad old world. In order to change the thinking of America, you have to sweep out traditional Judeo-Christian values and replace them with radical, secular, progressive values. If the public schools buy into the SP agenda, which many of them do, then children will be exposed to another way of thinking apart from what their parents believe. Thus, the public schools have become a major battleground in the culture war, and hostilities are heating up. Professor Lakoff has reinforced his SP vision of education with this definition on how the government should set up the learning apparatus, quote, "A vibrant, well-funded, and expanding public education system with the highest standards for every child in school, where teachers nurture children's minds and often the children themselves, and where children are taught the truth about their nation, its wonders, and its blemishes," unquote. This pointed advice underscores my point. The SP movement wants more authority for teachers and administrators and less for parents. Since most colleges are now firmly in the SP camp, and colleges train the teachers of your children, just do the math. In addition, the secular progressives are adamantly against vouchers for poor kids that would allow them the option of attending private schools. Why? Easy. Most private schools would never even consider a sex survey for second graders, because that would be an intrusion on parental authority. In general, moreover, private schools pose a grave threat to the SPs because many of them reject secularism and teach traditional values. Public schools, however, are quite a different story. As mentioned, more and more of them are becoming SP-friendly. It is fascinating, if a bit scary, to watch the SP game plan to target American children in action. SP indoctrination of kids is the goal, but the strategy is largely hidden behind the touchy-feely, nurturing description of education. However, if you cut through all the bull, the key question is clear. If SPs are sincerely looking out for the kids, what is the secular progressive philosophy on criminal justice, especially when children are directly affected? A brutal criminal case in Vermont and a civil lawsuit in Massachusetts shed some powerful light on that question. At 6 years old, Susie, not her real name, was by all accounts an adorable child. Cute and generally nice to be around, Susie enjoyed the rural outdoor life in northern Vermont. But then, oddly, Susie began to change. She became withdrawn, sometimes sullen, and she didn't want to leave her house all that much. The innocent smiles of her toddler days had become only a memory to those who knew her. Susie lived with her uneducated mother and stepfather in a trailer home. Every Sunday, beginning when the girl was 6 years old, her mother's friend from high school, a laborer by the name of Mark Hewlett, then 30, would babysit for a few hours. This arrangement went on for about 4 years, until Susie was 10. And during that time, Hewlett repeatedly raped the little girl. Finally, Susie told her parents the story. Hewlett was charged with a variety of sexual felonies and pled guilty. In a shocking statement, he explicitly told authorities what he had done to the little girl. I can't recount what Hewlett confessed to doing in these pages. The confession is simply too monstrous. Presiding over the case was Judge Edward Cashman, a Vietnam vet with a rather eccentric sentencing record. In some cases, Cashman handed down tough penalties, but at other times he was inexplicably inappropriate. For example, the Burlington Free Press reported that he told a rape victim she had experienced, quote, one of the harsh realities of life, unquote. After the young woman burst out crying, Cashman apologized. Onlookers in the courtroom were aghast. As the confessed child rapist, Mark Hewlett, stood before Judge Edward Cashman, some in the courtroom were expecting the criminal to get the maximum sentence, life in prison. Instead, Cashman handed down a sentence of 60 days to 10 years in state prison, and all but 60 days of the sentence was suspended. Why? So that the rapist could get treatment outside of prison. Quote, the one message I want to get through is that anger doesn't solve anything, the judge explained. It just corrodes your soul, unquote. Susie's family was stunned. A man who had brutally and methodically violated an innocent child over a 4-year period would be serving less time in prison than Martha Stewart had. How could this happen in America? Surely the civil liberties groups, the press, and the public would not stand for it. Wrong. Most of the Vermont media, generally very liberal, actually supported the judge. In a shocking display of journalistic irresponsibility, the media portrayed him as a courageous man bent on reforming the justice system. Noah Hoffenberg, the editorial director of the Bennington Banner, summarized the Vermont media position. Quote, we can see sexual predation as the disease itself and make every attempt, as Judge Cashman did, to get to the source of the illness, thereby preventing the devastation of sexual assault in the future, unquote. So according to many in the Vermont media, child rape is an illness, not to be punished, but to be treated. Believe me, this kind of insane thinking is very, very common in the secular progressive movement. In fact, there's even a name for it. Restorative justice. During my investigation of Judge Cashman, I found that he actually taught a course on restorative justice at the National Judicial College, which advertises itself as the nation's top judicial training institution. In other words, Cashman is a huge proponent of this madness, which encourages the legal system to find a way to reintegrate offenders into society. The restorative crowd doesn't believe in retribution for crimes. They believe in repairing harm for both the victim and the offender. That is to say, society has a responsibility not only to the person who is harmed, but also to the person doing the harm. Criminals need to be nurtured. The SPs strike again. Don't believe me? Well, guess who else has poured millions into getting restorative justice into the minds of those in the U.S. legal system? Does the name George Soros ring a bell? Here's how bad this Vermont situation really was. Shortly after Judge Cashman sentenced the child rapist Hewlett to 60 days, a man named Ralph Page ambled into the courtroom of another Vermont judge, Patricia Zimmerman. Page was there to answer charges that he had punched a woman in the face. Upon hearing the evidence against him, Page screamed at Judge Zimmerman, "That's effing bull!" The judge promptly ruled Page in contempt of court and sentenced him to, you guessed it, 60 days in jail. So there you have it. In Vermont, you can get the same amount of jail time for systematically raping a little child over a 4-year period as you can for cursing before a judge. As for Judge Cashman, he remained defiantly steadfast. Before issuing his atrocious sentence, Cashman listened to the plea of the little girl's aunt, June Benway, who broke down sobbing in the courtroom while saying, quote, "The thought of my niece enduring years of sexual abuse sickens me. For 4 years, she was a prisoner in her own home. For 4 years, she had to fear going to bed at night. She's already developed behavioral problems that help to alienate herself from her peers. When she's an adult, she won't be able to reminisce about her first kiss and experience the laughter and joy that should come with that memory. For her, the thought of her first kiss will probably evoke anger and pain. Her first kiss should not have been shared with some pervert." Unquote. But Cashman was unmoved by the words of Miss Benway. After she finished her statement, the judge began his explanation of the justice he was dispensing. Quote, "I feel very strongly about retribution, and why? I didn't come to that easy. It isn't something that I started at. I started out as a just dessert sentencer. I liked it. Cross the line, popped them. Then I discovered it accomplishes nothing of value. It doesn't make anything better. And I keep telling prosecutors, and they won't hear me, that punishment is not enough. You can't be satisfied with punishment." Unquote. So in the mind of Vermont Judge Edward Cashman, harshly punishing a child rapist is not the answer. Restorative justice is. This abdication of common sense is truly shocking in a nation built on the bedrock concept of equal justice for all, and that the punishment must fit the crime. But Vermont, it seems, has left the United States. Asked about Cashman's deplorable decision, retired Vermont Chief Justice Jeffrey Amestoy described Cashman as a, quote, "competent, caring, and conservative trial judge," unquote. Maybe in the land of Oz he would be. Cashman's outrageous behavior and the Vermont media's acceptance of it made me furious. I was personally outraged and figured the national media would feel the same way I did. So I vigorously reported the story and asked the national press barons to get behind me and support the little girl and her family. They did not. Once again, I was the naive culture warrior. Please call me Dopey Sue. The network news organizations and CNN totally ignored the story, as did the major urban newspapers. Even though millions of Americans were deeply concerned and angered, the elite media passed. Perhaps encouraged by the national media's apathy, some Vermont newspapers picked up the pace and actually began attacking me for my anti-Cashman stance. The Brattleboro Reformer called Cashman "one tough judge" in its headline and implied that I was a demagogue. The Rutland Herald editorialized, quote, "Cashman issued the sentence precisely to protect children. It was the only way to provide Hewlett the treatment he needs in a timely manner, in order to deter him from committing a similar offense in the future," unquote. The only way? I believe life in prison would deter Hewlett from raping another child, would it not? In fact, the only newspaper in Vermont to initially criticize Cashman was the Burlington Free Press, which also skewered me so it could have it both ways. But most Vermont media fell in with the SP troops, a disgraceful exhibition that is not easy to digest. The plight of and justice for little Susie was obviously secondary to the needs of the rapist, and the Vermont media had no problem with that. Yet the more I thought about the situation, the more it came to make sense. Vermont is the land of Howard Dean, who was 5 times elected governor. It is a state split between traditionalists and secular progressives, with the SPs obviously controlling much of the media. The public outcry in Vermont was also muted. To be sure, thousands of Vermonters were angry, but many of them told Factor producers they were afraid to stand up for fear of criticism. Everyone agreed there is a powerful and intimidating SP presence in the state of Vermont. But the Factor culture warriors wouldn't let go. My staff and I pounded the story night after night with revelations about Vermont's weak leaders and chaotic legislature. Thousands of Americans besieged the Vermont governor with emails. Finally, the state wobbled. Judge Cashman, realizing his career was sliding down a drain, issued a new sentence for the child rapist Hewlett, 3 to 10 years, and Hewlett would get treatment in the big house. This case is one of the most vivid examples of the culture war ever on display. A guy rapes a little girl over a 4-year period, and it takes an intensely fought national battle just to see he spends 3 years in prison. Most legal experts in Vermont believe Hewlett will be paroled after doing the minimum. There is no question the little girl's human rights were violated, but not one person from the SP Group's Human Rights Watch, the ACLU, or the National Organization for Women stepped up to protect her. Likewise, liberal Vermont politicians who are supposedly looking out for the downtrodden, like Senators Jeffords and Leahy, Governor Dean, and Congressman Bernie Sanders, said not a word. All the SP warriors sat it out, and that's a fact. Now, the logical question is, why would the SP movement want to stand behind an insane sentence for a child rapist? What's in it for them? Well, we've explored the restorative justice link, but there's also something else. In the SP world, few judgments are made about personal behavior. The old "if it feels good, do it" adage from the 60s is commonly accepted. But usually even the ACLU draws the line at violent criminal behavior. However, the restorative justice concept is picking up steam in the SP ranks. The disease excuse is featured prominently in SP criminal philosophy. We shouldn't prosecute street-level dope dealers, for example. We should give them treatment, because substance abuse is a disease that needs to be cured, not punished. And it is the illness, not the person, that's the cause of the harm people might do. It's not really their fault, you see. In the words of Judge Edward Cashman, quote, "punishment is not the answer," unquote. Now, many of us would like to kill a person who raped our child. That's a natural reaction, a genuine emotional response to a crime that is so heinous it's off the chart. But in the brave new world of the SP movement, even child rape is not enough to condemn the criminal to spend much of his or her life behind bars. Even though the child is devastated for life, the criminal must be healed in order for true justice to take place. This is what America will come to if the secular progressives ever take over. And if you think I'm exaggerating, you're wrong. The states of Minnesota and Vermont have been heavily influenced by secular progressive thought. It is no accident that those two states are the only ones in the Union that officially sanction the philosophy of restorative justice. The final part of this miserable story deals with our pals at the New York Times, the all-the-news-that's-fit-to-print newspaper. Apparently, the plight of the little Vermont girl was not fit to print because the Times totally ignored the story. Now, I thought that rather strange. You'll remember the vicious attack on me by Times columnist Nicholas Kristof over the Christmas controversy. Kristof, the human rights guy, described me as akin to a Muslim fundamentalist. He also challenged me to join him in reporting human rights abuses abroad. Well, here's my question. If Africa is in play, Nick, why not Vermont? So on February 3rd, 2006... I dedicated my syndicated newspaper column to Kristof and his employers at the Times and wrote this, quote, "Here's an update on that young Vermont girl whose life has been made a living hell by a justice system that literally could not care less about her. You may remember that 34-year-old Mark Hewlett pleaded guilty to raping the child over a 4-year period, starting when she was just 6 years old. The judge in the case frowned when he heard the confession and promptly sentenced the vicious criminal to 60 days in prison. A few journalists, including myself, picked up on the outrage, and under enormous pressure, Judge Edward Cashman changed the sentence to 3 years. Still an incredible miscarriage of justice. The girl, now 10, is being raised by foster parents. Vermont authorities believe her mother and stepfather are incapable of properly protecting the child. She is undergoing counseling and is in school, but according to those who see her every day, she's confused and unhappy. Surely this young girl's human rights have been violated. No person on earth should have to suffer the way she has." A few weeks ago, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof criticized me for reporting on the Christmas controversy. Kristof asserted that I fabricated the story and ignored real stories like the suffering in the Sudan. Kristof wrote, quote, "So I have a challenge for Mr. O'Reilly. If you really want to defend traditional values, then come with me on a trip to Darfur. I'll introduce you to mothers who have had their babies clubbed to death in front of them to teenage girls who have been gang raped," unquote. Now, I do 3 hours of daily news analysis on TV and radio, so there's no way I can go to Africa in light of those commitments. However, I'm glad Kristof can go, because somebody needs to spotlight that terrible situation. But an interesting thing happened shortly after that Christoph column. The 60-day sentence for the child rapist came to light. Because Christoph had referenced teenage rape in his criticism of me, I fully expected to see the New York Times all over the Vermont situation. After all, this human rights violation happened just a few hundred miles north of New York City. But the Times didn't cover the Vermont story, didn't even mention it. And there was not a word from my pal, Nicholas Christoph, the human rights guy. So what's going on here? Aren't liberal press advocates champions of the downtrodden? Maybe Christoph can write another column explaining to me why the Vermont child doesn't matter to him or his newspaper. I hope this doesn't sound bitter because I don't mean it to be. I'm genuinely perplexed by the sanctimonious left-wing press, which doesn't consider a 60-day jail term for a child rapist an outrage. While the Times rails against alleged human rights violations in Guantanamo Bay and other far-off places, it apparently has no interest in protecting poor American children from predators and irresponsible judges. Something isn't right here. What say you on the left? Now, that column was written with the intention of embarrassing Nicholas Christoph and the New York Times, I admit it. Remember, that newspaper is the secular progressive Bible. My feeling is that the Times ignored the Vermont story because I was so involved in it and because the Times is definitely on board with the restorative justice movement, but I could be wrong. For the record, about a week after I wrote that column calling the Times out for ignoring the little girl in Vermont, Nicholas Christoph wrote another column asking his readers to send money so a ticket could be purchased in order to send me to Africa. It was a dopey article, the point of which escaped just about everybody I know. But Christoph did comment on my crusading for justice in Vermont. He called it, quote, good stuff, unquote. Well, thanks, Nick. But I'm still waiting for your employers to assign someone to expose the myriad of human rights violations going on inside the United States. It'd be great for the powerful New York Times to get behind Jessica's Law, a tough anti-sexual predator law being adopted by states across the country, wouldn't it? Never going to happen. And the atrocities keep on coming in the USA. Soon after the Vermont debacle, an Ohio judge named John Connor pronounced sentence on a man who forced a 5-year-old boy and an 11-year-old boy to have sex with him. The man admitted committing the felonies and to doing a number of other horrendous things to these children. Connor could have sentenced the predator to 10 years in prison, but he didn't. He gave the degenerate probation. No prison time at all. Connor pronounced the man had a disease. I let Judge Connor have it on the factor, arguing that the state had to impeach him. Even after the Vermont experience, I thought the Ohio press would be on my side. The Toledo Blade was, but most of the other media condemned me. Newspapers in Cincinnati, Akron, and Dayton actually supported Connor. It was another shocking display of media irresponsibility. The Dayton Daily News was the worst. It leveled personal attacks on me, the governor of Ohio, and the attorney general of the state for demanding Connor's removal. It was perhaps the most despicable thing I have ever seen in an American newspaper, and no surprise, the Dayton paper is a bastion of secular progressive opinion. Taking the evidence presented, I believe it's fair to say that not only does the SP movement sympathize with child predators because of their disease, they are also making it easier for these criminals to operate. To prove this, we must travel to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, a reliable stronghold of secular progressive thought. Earlier in this book, I mentioned that the ACLU is representing the North American Man-Boy Love Association in a civil lawsuit. That case, I argue, proves the ACLU is not only misguided, it's dangerous. Here are some more details that I hope prove this point once and for all. We begin with the fact that the ACLU believes NAMBLA's rights are being violated, so please consider that the starting point of this terrible situation. On October 1, 1997, 10-year-old Jeffrey Curley was playing in the front yard of his Cambridge, Massachusetts home. A few yards away, two men, Salvatore Sicari and Charles Janes, were watching Jeffrey from their parked car. Sicari and Janes talked it over. Could they kidnap the boy and get away unseen? It was risky in broad daylight, but the men, losers both, decided to try. Leaping out of the car, they grabbed the boy, threw him inside, and sped off. But Jeffrey fought back hard. Finally, the men suffocated the boy with a gasoline-soaked rag and drove to Jane's apartment where they sexually abused Jeffrey's body. Afterward, they drove to Maine, where they dumped the young boy's corpse in a river. it does not get worse than this. Massachusetts detectives did a great job on the case, and both Zachary and James received life in prison. During court testimony, James's diary was introduced. In said diary was a description of the NAMBLA website, and James's writing that it encouraged him to act out his violent fantasies concerning young boys. As I told you earlier, James accessed the NAMBLA website at the Boston Public Library. Remember, the ACLU and the SP movement want no restrictions on library internet access. Not surprisingly, Jeffrey Curley's family was so appalled by the NAMBLA connection that they filed a $200 million federal lawsuit against the group, seeking to put it out of business once and for all. It fell to the Curley family to attempt to do what the U.S. justice system has not been able to do, crush NAMBLA. By the way, it's worth noting that one of the most popular NAMBLA publications is titled The Survival Manual, The Man's Guide to Staying Alive in Man-Boy Sexual Relationships. This revolting manual explains how to insinuate yourself into a child's life and get away with molesting a boy. Sick doesn't even begin to cover it. After the Curley family filed its lawsuit, it was answered by the ACLU. The SP shock troops took the case to protect the freedom of speech rights of NAMBLA. ACLU Massachusetts Legal Director John Reinstein said in a press release, quote, "Regardless of whether people agree or abhor NAMBLA's views, holding the organization responsible for crimes committed by others who read their material would gravely endanger important First Amendment freedoms," unquote. Once again, a theoretical argument is put forth to defend active evil. As with the war on terror, the SP vanguard can't come to grips with the fact that NAMBLA has no place in any civilized society, is an organization that appears to be criminal, encouraging child rape, and it should be put out of business any legal way possible. But in the anything-goes world of the secular progressives, theory is much more important than protecting the kids. One more item to bolster my argument. The ACLU's war against the Boy Scouts has received a lot of attention. Very simply, the Scouts decline to approve openly gay Scout masters and require that the boys acknowledge a higher power. The ACLU sees this as a violation of gay and atheist rights, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that the Scouts and all other private organizations have the right to make their own charters and rules. So all over the country, the ACLU has sued the Boy Scouts, seeking to have them denied public assistance and access, such as having a jamboree on city property. It is a jihad against the Scouts, no question. Once again, doing the math, I've come up with this equation. NAMBLA gets ACLU support. The Boy Scouts get ACLU attacks. Am I wrong here? Finally, let's go back to school, where the SP assault on American children is being intensely waged under the guise of looking out for the kids. Besides abortion, the one issue that will drive any secular progressive crazy is school vouchers for disadvantaged children. Because so many public schools are ineptly run and even dangerous to attend, states like Florida have provided assistance to poor families who wish to send their kids to private schools. In the high school where I taught, in the 1970s, Monsignor Edward Pace in Opa-locka, Florida, 40 low-income students were receiving tuition assistance from the state of Florida. But the SP Florida Supreme Court, you remember, the one that ruled in favor of Al Gore in the 2000 election and was overturned by the Supreme Court, decided that Florida violated its own constitution by directing fees to private schools. Predictably, the court rationalized its ruling by invoking the separation of church and state theory. But in the real world, where most of us have to live, many of the poor children involved were forced to return to violent, chaotic public schools. The secular progressives will tell you they're looking out for your rights and the overall welfare of children in the school voucher debate. But that's an impossible argument to win when you realize that a poor kid doesn't have the same rights as a rich kid to attend a school their parents choose. This is flat-out classism and a stark denial of equal opportunity. But as we've learned, the true SP agenda wants nothing to do with the traditional Judeo-Christian values that are taught in most private schools. That's really the issue here. The separation of church and state argument is just a ruse, and there's proof. After World War II, more than 2 million veterans were given educational vouchers paid for by the government in order to afford to attend the college of their choice. Many of those vets chose religious colleges. Back then, the SP movement was in its infancy, and little was said. But over the years, as the SP forces in America grew in strength, the opposition to all government assistance involving any religious affiliation intensified. Came to a head in a 1999 lawsuit involving educational assistance to the poor in Cleveland, Ohio. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that as long as the government didn't force an American student